Hello, and welcome to AMO Kenzoku. We are a group of four bubblegum crisis boomer otaku who wanted an excuse to talk about anime, manga, and any related subjects we find interesting. The Kenzoku are...
Hey, I'm Nick.
Hey, I'm Sam.
Hey, all, I'm Mike.
And I am your host tonight, Dylan. This is episode 72, being recorded on July 10th of 2025. And today we will be getting into the Wayback Machine to the 2001 film Millennium Actress, or Sennen Joyu. So with that, I say Hashin. So this will be the last film that we'll be able to do an episode of from Satoshi Kon, which is incredibly sad. There's no other feeling I could have than just sadness that we've done episodes on every single film that he directed, and we'll certainly do Paranoia Agent at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I watched a couple things, and someone described the plot of this movie as a documentary interviewer and camera person go to review a retired actress about her film career.
Yeah.
And you could take that and be like, huh.
That's like 80% of it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like that's the literal summary of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd say, well, that sounds like a boring thing that goes nowhere, does nothing, and there's no point to anything. But then you add in the caveat and you're like, yeah, but it's written and storyboarded and directed by Satoshi Kon. And then you go, oh, okay, well, this is going to be excellent. And I think it's really interesting that it's such a simple plot where you could tell someone, oh, that's what the movie is. And you'd be like, well, that's correct, but it's also completely wrong.
Yeah.
And the movie also gives away the entire movie within the first 2 minutes of it without giving away anything, because in the first 2 minutes where they go into kind of do the credits after the you zoom out into the first earthquake, and then it does a rewind through various scenes in the movie as the movie title shows up.
Mm-hmm.
So you also see
it's because the director is actually reviewing the film, like, right? Like it's kind of like this whole movie is like movieception.
Yeah.
In every sense of the word, because remember it fades in and he's actually in that, what do we call the device where he's reviewing, you know, like old recorded film, and he's using the little dials to like fast forward and reverse through it.
So
that was like the whole meta thing where he's like actually watching the end of the movie that he just finished is kind of almost how I interpret it.
I thought he was reviewing just her movies, because like just
well
before
it
they
could
leave.
Be that like there's a lot of stuff, not a lot, but there are a few things in this movie that are left pretty vague. I think this was definitely this is kind of a more lucid but still leaving some open-ended stuff compared to like Perfect Blue, which had a lot of open-ended stuff. I think this movie still had a few open-ended things that made it up to interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, well, I'm sure we'll get into that.
Yeah, I'm with Sam on my take being that it was reviewing the footage of her movies beforehand.
Well, the only reason why I'm saying it could be him reviewing what he just filmed was because, and if you're talking about the cut where they're going on the rocket ship, like he and his cameraman are in it. Mm-hmm. So that's my only like justification there.
True.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh gosh, are they in that there? But it's...
Well, it's... Huh. I guess that's tough to say, right? Because when it zooms out to the title, obviously it's past that point, and then I'm not sure I didn't review it thoroughly, but if and in any of the rewinding, if they're actually like cuts with is it Genya, I think is the director
yeah.
guy's name, and mm-hmm. his cameraman, I don't even remember that guy's name. I can't recall if they were in any of the other shots.
Ida, the cameraman.
Yeah, the Tsukomi guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as usual with Cohn, which I think at some level Tokyo Godfathers is kind of the exception, but that one still has fantastical elements to it. There's the element of the intersection between reality and dream and I almost want to say like desire. And in this one, in this version of that, as opposed to Perfect Blue, which he had done in 97, and this was originally the original first film film festival release was in 2001, but it didn't actually come out to Japan's theaters until 2002. But in there, you could say it's a very some similar themes, but done from a very different thing. Whereas Perfect Blue went suspense and horror and to all of these dark places and confusion and unsureness. And in going into it further, it's like you get further into the madness. This one does it, I would say, with whimsy and fun, where it's like, oh, well, yeah, you're going into this movie and you're not really sure if you're watching a film or you're watching a memory of a film or you're watching her off of a set or in a set or something else, but you're also not
I was going
to
say
made to feel bad about it.
It's almost the like not really opposite, but looking at it's two female actresses looking at their careers from different directions. Like one in the beginning of her career, like trying to start out, and then the other at the end, looking back at everything she did. I wonder if that was conscious that he decided to do something like this after Perfect Blue.
Yeah, it's almost like it's almost like it's a mirror image of Perfect Blue in some ways.
Yeah, that's a good word, mirror. Yeah, not
in
totally,
some ways, right? Because you see her from the like her being discovered and her first kind of efforts, but
it's like
I see
through
what you're
the
saying,
lens of her understanding.
Right. Yeah, I get what you're saying. Yeah, I think that is one of the charming points about it. I would say this movie, the best way to single word to describe this movie is charming. I think it's its most charming movie.
Yeah.
I feel like the plot is on it. Even though there's a few parts that are left to interpretation, you're basically given the hook of the movie very early. It's her chasing this guy and trying to find the best way to do it. And for her, it was get her face out there and just be in as many movies as possible. Maybe one day you'll find her. That's to me was the root message that she was. That's like basically the whole, I would say, crux of the movie. And if we want to start getting into analysis, I think that's actually kind of, in my opinion, its biggest weakness as well. Is it's kind of doesn't. I feel like the writing wise, this movie wrote itself into a corner quickly because it was hard for them to expand beyond that. In my opinion, like they never really developed past the point of she's always chasing after this guy and there's really nothing else to it.
Yeah.
At least that's how I interpreted it.
I was trying to, like, as I was watching, kind of sort through my feelings, obviously I haven't seen this in a very long time. And there were certain things that kind of bothered me about the plot. And maybe maybe you put a finger on it there where it's like, there is resolution in the movie, but it doesn't feel super satisfying in terms of like the plot. I mean, I feel like it ends in it really well. I think the ending is kind of perfect, but
I think it might be my favorite ending of his movies, which is, I would say, one of the redeeming factors for it. But yeah. I do agree. Other than that, I felt like it did, again, I felt like they wrote itself into a corner quickly and it just could not break out of it. That's kind of how my main interpretation of it.
Yeah, like the thing that kind of had me feeling weirder about the movie was when she gets the letter, right, and she's like going to go search for going to the man, the place in Hokkaido where the man said he would, you know, meet her or whatever, expecting to find him. And she does all that stuff. And there's not, you know, a lot of like flashbacks and things like that. But it just felt so different from the rest of the movie. And then she gets there and like, it's not like she needs to find the guy, right? Like, but it, like, yeah, it's hard for me to explain, but it doesn't feel like, yeah, it went anywhere. Like there was no motion at that point in the plot.
Yeah, I think, I mean, again, for me, I think what this movie is trying to do is kind of like show that a simple interaction can literally dictate a person's entire life, because that's really what happened to her, right? This mm-hmm. one, what was it, one night, really, she spent with this guy?
Yeah.
If that. And then, you know, he ends up being, I think the setup behind it was interesting, right? Because he was if I recall, this was pre-war was when she met him, or may have been just as the war was starting, and he was, you know, basically anti-government.
Mm-hmm.
So, but and that they were all being heavily persecuted at that time. He, you know, so he's on the run. And
it would have, it should have been about, 1937 that encounter happened, because, you know, she said that she was born during the Great Kanto earthquake in 23, and that she was 15 when she was discovered and started to do all this stuff there. So that puts it pretty squarely at 1937. Now, we can always take everything with a grain of con. We'll just call it not a grain of salt, a grain of con, which means that you got to mix a little bit of reality and unreality and dream.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's even more than what I said before. It's this mixing of like reality and dream and memory. And
fiction. It's got even more of that than the usual con work, I think, because, yeah, you add the memory layer in there. Like, most of them only have three of the four.
Mm-hmm. I guess one question I had about this stuff, especially in the start of the movie. So like she starts out and she gets into the movie business, and then it's all like a sequence of films. And my memory of this was that it was telling her story through her films. But like I'm on this viewing, I'm not sure that's what it was. And I'm also not sure exactly what it was like. Because it had the characters from her life acting out things that I'm pretty sure weren't happening. Like, I mean, abstracted, like if you kind of split out the action in these things, like the brothel or the feudal lord in the castle, like you can kind of guess at maybe what that means for her life. But like she never ran into the man with the key. At that point, she never found him, but in these films, she did. So I don't know. What do you guys think was going on with that?
My interpretation is that the films themselves, their plots mimicked kind of what happened to her. Not necessarily by her, because she influenced it that way, but that's just how the movies were. And I think that was kind of why they blended so well. I'm glad you brought that up, because the one thing that really I really still don't understand or have a good answer to is who is the old hag with the spindle? Who is she and what does she represent?
Yeah.
Because I don't understand. I hate you the most and I love you the most. I'm like, okay, who are you? Because my understanding was she was a character from that movie, but she kept reappearing in mm-hmm. some certain, you know, I would say she's the one thing that causes some kind of discourse in the movie, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's like a record scratch. Like, when she appears, like, whoa, what's going on? Like, everything kind of comes to a screeching halt, right? Chiyoko kind of pauses and freaks out a little bit. And then, she does something erratic after that, or an earthquake happens. Like, is the hag supposed to represent the coming of earthquakes? Like, that's the one thing about the movie I simply could not find a clear answer to, at least as far as from my interpretation of things.
My thought with that is that my general thought with these things is these were movies that she was in. I think we all agree with that. And then, like, some of the stuff in the movies had an impact on her, and that hag somehow, that just affected her somehow with her journey of trying to find this man imprinted on her and made her doubt herself or something. And so that's why that comes back, and not necessarily that it was any particular person. Like, I don't know. That's as good as I got. I don't know. Dylan, do you have a better idea?
So I think around that and everything, and I think this movie, more than any of his other films, the fantastical elements of this one it leans into is memory and the fiction of memory. And I've saying this now, you know, that's why I like having these discussions, because I think about these things a lot more and come to some hypotheses on the fly here. That, I think, is the fantasy, whereas in both Paprika and Perfect Blue, it's a lot more on kind of the... Paprika's very heavy on the dream element, mm-hmm. obviously, and Paprika's more on the kind of reality bending or not sure what things are happening, but this one is really so much in memory. And I think it also, it softens it because it comes at it from such this kind of whimsical fun thing where you're not sitting there, oh my gosh, what terrible things are going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I think that is really helped by the fact that her memories of when the time were darkest were told from her perspective when she was young, idealistic, and, you know, in love and romantically chasing after the guy. I think that's where some of the whimsy comes, because obviously the stuff actually happening then is really dark if you weren't seeing it from her perspective.
And as well, there's so much with that, with the and going back onto the old woman, I'm not sure. I agree. I'm kind of like, I'm not sure who she is either. But the one thing I'll go into is the whole thing with the movie and the music and everything is the idea of cycles and things spinning around and around. And she has the spinning wheel, which clearly does a lot of cycles and loops around. And the music is intentionally cyclical and comes back on some of the same things. And Susumu has said that, you know, he did a lot of stuff where it was this very intentional, I forget his exact words because they're fancy, but this very intentional cyclical kind of rhythm that comes through in the music. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's, in some ways, I'm like, I think the old woman is almost like her memories warped version of herself saying something to herself to her past self in the future from the past, and that it was influenced by a character in a movie that she then took and superimposed on the rest of her memories.
So it's almost like she has this, yeah. Part of that, I guess, that's a lot of stuff there, but part of that being that, like, what we're seeing in the movie may not necessarily be entirely what happened. I mean, beyond the obvious fantasticalness of it, but, like, this could be, her present self projecting into her memories, maybe even current feelings about things.
Yeah. I think I'm trying to say something along those lines, which is very convoluted and not a fully thought out hypothesis, but
and also not outside of the con realm of possibilities.
Nope, and as he intentionally leaves, even in a movie like this, where the plot and everything else feels like so straightforward, and just like, oh yeah, A, B, C, okay, great, we're there, we got it, we had a fun ride along the way, and but then as you think about it more in this way, you're kind of like, huh, yeah, how much of this is a real memory or a real film, which you could say a film is a memory captured that's immutable, but even those are being changed by the retelling of it, and then the putting of the documentary people in the memory as they go along for the ride as well. And some of that obviously is done for theatrical purpose because it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, I don't put anything past Khan to do something that he puts. And I think that's the thing in all of his films, is that he has so much of this just cool, interesting things and perspectives and stuff that you can look at and think about. And I'm not sure if he was really conscious about everything he did or if he was just...
Mm-hmm.
A muse and all of those weird ideas and things flowed through him and he did it, but he didn't quite really know what he was doing.
I think that there's definitely some of that in there. Like, I do think Khan is a genius for sure. And I think with that comes some amount of seat of your pantsness, for better or worse, right? Like, that kind of, I guess this would be like what he called Chimpira Khan in the previous stuff we watched, or it's like, yeah, you know what? I think this is cool. I'm going to do this. This, you know, maybe it's not the greatest choice, but you know, I can do it. So I will.
I can definitely see that being a thing for sure.
Yeah. This movie makes you work a bit more, I think, than, Perfect Blue. Like, Perfect Blue is a very intentionally convoluted movie, I think, in a very good way. But this movie appears more straightforward, and maybe I'm making excuses, right? But it appears much more straightforward if you just watch it. But then if you try and think about it, you're like, okay, but how do these things relate? What was going on? You know, like, who was the woman with the spinning wheel? Like, what was I watching in all those memories? Because, you know, it's such a fun ride. Like, I'm not, like, I think what happened the first time I watched it is I experienced all that really fun ride in the first, whatever, two-thirds of the movie, not really evaluating critically what it meant. And now I'm trying to think, you know, I'm watching it in the more critical eye and thinking, okay, now how does this movie work as a whole? I don't think it's not as straightforward as I thought it was originally.
Yeah, I think I'm coming to that too. And as I think about that with relation to putting that word memory first and foremost, and it's one of those things where, like, you can recite a memory and you can say, oh, well, I was here and I did this and I did that. And you can go back and recite the same memory a year later, 5 years later, and you'll have completely different things.
Mm-hmm.
I forget if it was a podcast or something I left, but they did, people did a bunch of research on this, and they try to do it around these big, I forget what they call them, these big inflection point or mass, kind of mass moments. And one that I remember from this research they done was around 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And basically right after 9/11, like literally it was like within the day or so after, these people went through and like kind of just a wide survey of people and said, hey, tell me where you were, what you were doing. Tell me everything about this around 9/11 that you remember. Because everyone feels like they have that was around during that time feels like, mm-hmm. Okay, I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing. Yeah. And who I was with and all these other details and things.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went back to talk to these same people. Like, I forget the exact stuff, but it was something like a year later, 5 years later, 10 years later, and asked them to recall and tell them the same thing. And people would like a good percentage of people, like it was something, I'm making this up in my head, but it was something, it was like at least 80% of people would have completely different stories of their memory of this. Like they would change all sorts of details, including even like where they were and what they were doing and all of these other things. Uh-huh. And then the researchers would go back and they would either like play them the tape or like read them the transcript to these people said when from the like the day after, or like, you know, I'll call it within the first week or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the people would be like, well, no, I was lying then. Clearly, that's not what happened.
Wow.
And from an objective purpose, you can be like, well, it's more likely that they were correct in what they said then, but that people go through and are, you reconvince yourself of these memories and things. Now, was Cohn aware of all of this research and these things that happened and all of this other stuff? Consciously? Probably not.
Probably not, yeah.
But through his various things that he was influenced by and read and thought about and the things going through his brain, it was clearly there. Because I think that, as I go through it and think about this movie again, I'm like, I think it's a very interesting monologue on memory. Mm-hmm. is an interesting sub point in this whole thing. So that's my monologue.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. I mean, I'm kind of thinking about it from that perspective. I'm a little disappointed he didn't play with that a little bit more, because he had, you know, two people who were there at the same time, right, recalling their memories. And he did use it in some perspective, but it was more like, well, what is his name? Genya. Genya, thank you. Genya. Like, Genya was there on set for some of these moments, and he saw them. And then, you know, like with the man with the scar, right, he got the second half of that interaction, but there were no cases, I think, where their memories disagreed, which would, I guess, would have been interesting to see. Or did I miss any?
Mm-mm. No, you're right. I think everything was in line. I think it was also anything that was shown what could have been also kind of like the the average of what Genya and what Gioko's memories were. And, you know, maybe certain things were different, but the general messaging was the same for to keep it, you know, feeling, let's call it, smooth.
Yeah. And he could have been maybe changing his story too to match hers for her benefit.
That's actually one of those things that you're just, as you described that right now, I'm like, it's quite possible that she was describing the stuff, and then he, for her benefit, or for the 57 times that he cried at each of her scenes that he saw in movies and stuff, that he then, not even consciously, changed his memory to agree with hers, to the point of, hey, who even knows if he actually was the one who saved her when the studio collapse happened?
Huh. Oh, yeah.
Now, let me get crazy there. What if it actually wasn't him, but he remembered it being him because it happened and he heard it happening and he substituted his mm-hmm. memory in there? And she was fine with it too.
Yeah.
Yeah, but ultimately, this is where I want to interject and say, like, that's all well and good, but at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if he did it or not, right? Because it was in the past, and it still led to where they were today. So even if we wanted to talk about that, ultimately it was meaningless, right? And that's kind of where I start to have issue with it as well, is all this is well and good, but ultimately it's all, like, yeah, we can interpret it that way, but to me, it didn't alter the end result, and that's why I think it fell a little flatter for me than other movies, other Cohn's movies. Like, ultimately, I think it's likely was meant to be more of a thought exercise at points, but to me, it didn't give enough incentive to go into those thoughts. Like, Perfect Blue, to me, incentivizes really thinking and, like, scrutinizing, because Perfect Blue is so herky-jerky, right? Like, I feel like with Perfect Blue, we were being dragged by the wrist. And, you know, suddenly, you know, left, suddenly right, you know, up, down, like, we were being controlled by the movie's, you know, like, pacing, and the movie was dictating it for us. We didn't have a choice. Millennium Actress, to me, everything was so slow, mundane, and repetitive that it didn't really incentivize me to do that while I was watching it.
When you say it didn't matter, you're talking about, like, though they had the tender connection over him, like, saving her life or him being on the set or whatever, like, it didn't really change
the outcome.
Right.
It didn't change the ultimate outcome, is my thing.
Yeah, no plot progress from that. It was just a moment that they used a few times. That's interesting.
Yeah, and that being said, the one thing Genya was in control of and I thought was interesting he opted to withhold the entire time was he actually had knowledge, theoretically, the entire time he was interviewing her, because he learned this when he was young, right? Mm-hmm. From the Scarred Man. The artist was dead.
Right.
Like, long ago, probably. But, and Genya knew this because there was that, they did that thing where they do where you see him kneeling down to help the Scarred Man and you see his eyes go wide. It's obviously heard something.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the one thing I question is, was he really doing Chiyoko a favor by withholding that the entire time? I don't know. I can't answer that. It's because when you think about it, that's kind of messed up. When he hears from her, like, her entire life, more or less, was dedicated to finding this guy. And he had the information the whole time. Like, would it have been better for him to tell her as soon as possible so that she could move on? And instead of, it could be that he couldn't, because he did say, "Why did you disappear?" So maybe he couldn't find her for the entire time. Like, literally, the interview was the first time. But then again, he should have known that he had the way, because as long as he had the key, he shouldn't have known that he could have gotten an interview with her at any time. So that's probably the one thing I would say that invokes a little bit more contemplative thought for me is, when did he get the key? I guess we know when, because when the earthquake happened, he pulled it out from the wreckage. So he had it a long time. So, in my opinion, he should have had the means to send out a newspaper. Or even if he didn't know where she was, he could have printed a newspaper article saying, "Hey, to Fujiwara Chiyoko, I have what you desire most, please meet with me," and he could have done that. And then he could have told her, right? Like, I feel like he could have, at some point in his career, could have done that, because he obviously saw some degree of success continuing in the production company, right? Because he became a director himself eventually. So that's the more interesting question. Like, you know, from my perspective, I think he should have just told her so she could have led, you know, the rest of her life how she wanted. But then again, the final line, actually, I had issue with the translation on Crunchyroll, and I don't remember if this was how it was on the DVD or Blu-ray, because I watched it on Crunchyroll. But what she said in Japanese, transliterated on the very final line she had going into space, right, which was an allegory for her passing away, was, "The version of myself I loved the most was when I was chasing after him," is what she said. But I don't think that's what was translated in Crunchy. It was grossly simplified from what I remember. I don't remember what the subs exactly said, but the messaging to me wasn't the same. So I was a little frustrated with that translation because I think the nuance there is important, right? She's saying that ultimately she actually enjoyed her journey of chasing him more than actually finding him, is what I inferred from her final statement.
Yeah, because I don't remember the translation.
I could just literally cue it up.
Yeah, I forget. It was something that way. I think that's a good... let's see here. I want to segue into the key and the scar and those things. Before we go over into that way, Mike, did you have anything on the memories, true or false, or anything that way?
I'm just thinking that I really want to rewatch Magnetic Rose now and see how the two takes compare.
Yeah.
Since I knew they were on a similar subject, but they definitely are closer than I thought in a lot of ways. Because it had been a while since I'd watched them both.
Was Cohn involved in Magnetic Rose as well?
I believe he wrote the screenplay.
Oh, well, that's why that one is so freaking good then. he wrote Magnetic Rose and also did background design and layouts. Yeah, no wonder that one is brilliant. Okay, got it. Yeah, no problem.
I mean, they're all kind of brilliant, right?
Like, they are all. That's one of the all. So that one will make our list at that one will make our viewing list at some point. It's another one that we haven't also all haven't all watched at some point. Yep, that makes sense as well there too. Okay, so let's go into the key and the scar and the thing that we desire most. Because I do think that is, it's interesting, and it's also one of these things there where, first of all, the man with the key has the most desirable voice of anyone in the world, which is Koichi Yamadera doing his very Shibui voice.
I mean, so, I don't deny Yamadera as him is pretty pretty stellar, but I mean, there's a lot of great voice acting, I feel like, in this.
Oh yes, I'm just being a little cheeky there. That,
well, let's call it his chief rival, who's Otaki, the director, the younger director, who ultimately married her. He was voiced by Hirotaka Suzuki, who is equally stellar. I mean, he's Saito and Bright Noah, so.
Right, yeah.
The two male, I would say, primary male leads in this are, I mean, to me, they go head-to-head. So.
Yeah. So let's talk about kind of like the reality and the unreality of the man with the key and the man with the scar. Mm. Because it's kind of interesting, and like that, I believe, is how they're credited in the film, is like Kagi no, at least on the wiki, it's got Kagi no Kimi, mm-hmm, as the man with the key, and Kizu no Otoko. Which is kind of interesting that these two foils in different ways for her, but neither of them have a name. And her seeking after the man with the key is, it gets so strange in that, like, the first place she goes is, you know, and part of it is just like, well, that's where the film and the money is to go to Manchuria. But then she believes that he's, like, in northern Manchuria, and that's the place he's talking about, even though, like, he was clearly speaking good Japanese and talking about a snow-covered place. At least I would have thought of, like, oh, well, probably like Hokkaido or something like that.
Manchuria thing is because all people that were fleeing prosecution were going to Manchuria.
It wasn't
because he was claiming to be of Manchuria.
Okay,
he was fleeing to
that
Manchuria
makes sense.
Because he was a political target.
Okay, that makes sense. I'm on board now. Okay.
Well, then, what's her name? Tricked her with the fortune teller, right?
The older actress that hated her.
Yeah.
Shimao Eiko.
Yes, which was interesting. So there was like, that's where there was like some of that reality in the movie stuff of like, although it was, I guess that was, that part was presented between filmings, right? Like not actually in a movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that was like between filmings or during filming. I think it was like during filming of a thing in Manchuria that this happened,
like on
set. And then she said, tried to get her kicked off the film by having her go abandon filming.
Yeah, boy. Ruthless.
But I'm trying to figure here, like, how much of the man with the key is reality and how much of it is more of this aspirational idea that she gives a direct person to in the film here, of the idea of people really pursuing their dreams, and that the key is the thing that will unlock. And in my opinion, the key never actually, there was, it's an interesting thing too, where it's like the guy says, oh, this key unlocks the thing. Like, she has the key for decades. She never looks for the thing that the key unlocks.
Oh, hold on a second, though. I just had like a, wow, my mind opened up with Nick's comment about her line at the end of the movie, like, I enjoyed myself most in the chase, right? Like, that key was basically the thing that kept her on the chase the whole time, that in the end she says like was like it defined her as a person, right? And that she loved that. She really enjoyed that the most. She went into acting, I believe, right? Because she wanted to find the man.
Mm-hmm.
And without that key.
And actually, yeah, when she, that's a good point. When she lost it or when it was taken, she kind of gave up and married the director, right? Because she was like, oh, yeah. I guess it's over. So, and then it fast forwards who knows how many years when she finds it again. And then she, literally the moment she gets it,
yeah,
everything starts to go. All the events start to line up towards her restarting, right? Because suddenly then the scarred man appears, mm-hmm, out of nowhere and basically, you know, gives her this onus, the letter and this onus to go chase after the man again. So right. To back to your point, Dylan, I don't think it's as esoteric as did the man ever exist. I do think that the person existed, because otherwise where did the key come from? Like, I feel like it makes it more too arbitrary if you start thinking that too many things in this movie were like not were potentially, you know, false memory.
I wasn't trying to say that I didn't think he existed. I think I was trying to say more like at what point in her life or her memories does the key become, like you said, more like her persona or her talisman or whatever, and not a thing that is actually really like she's actually trying to find this guy. It's just this idea.
Mm. Sure. I think, yeah, definitely that there's discussion, room for discussion there. I do agree. Yeah. Was it really about finding the guy, or was it about, you know, for lack of a better term, like going through the motions of finding the guy, but that
the thrill
is
of the chase.
The thrill of the chase, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was thinking that, like, at what point did it become more performative because she, on some level, knew that the guy was probably dead and didn't want conclusive proof of that? Because that almost feels like what happened with when the man with the scar turned up again, because she took the letter, but she didn't ask any follow-up questions whatsoever. Mm-hmm. She just took off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like she intentionally knew she was had more to say, but she wanted to restart the chase because she felt like she had the itch more or less was reignited, right?
Mm. Yeah. She could run there and she could avoid the reality of the rest of the story if she didn't get it. And then in her, you know, there's probably a part of her that says, "But maybe he is there." And so she goes, and then if he's not there, well, then he must be somewhere else, right? And she can continue chasing. Although I guess she loses the key, though, right? So then she kind of stops again.
And then to kind of add another layer of reinventure, because I feel like part of this movie is reinventing yourself. And as an allegory to that, I think it's interesting that the character, Chiyoko's character, was voiced by three separate voice actresses for each stage of her life.
Oh,
when
yeah.
She was young, when she was an adult, and then when she was old. But each of them were different VAs.
Yeah.
It was so. a young, and one of her first breakout roles, Fumiko Orikasa, who's done tons of stuff and basically worked continuously since then. But this was one of her first earlier kind of lead roles.
I want to say early 2000s when she started to have lead roles, but she was only working since like the late 90s, so I think mm-hmm. you were right.
Yeah. One of the other things that I think is really interesting with this film, and this is a little bit more into the production side of stuff on this here, is how much the movie was made for. Did everyone else look this number up or not?
No.
I mean, it's a Madhouse movie, so it has to be, like, pitifully low.
Yeah. It was made for roughly... it was actually... I think it was made for below its original intended budget and was made for around 100 million yen. Literally, like, $1 million.
Yeah, it looks like... it says 1.2 million.
Yeah.
Was the budget. Like, so, yeah, it was...
I think it was something under than that they made it for. Which
yeah,
is
but
just
the box office was like really pitiful. So,
well, the U.S. box office, at least.
Yeah, you're right. That is the U.S. box office.
Yeah, and that, like, it's hard to say, like, yeah, the, because I feel like Japanese box office numbers and those things are sometimes a little bit weirder to find and things. I didn't dig in too much further, but it just stuns me to look and say something like a film like this that we can go look at and watch almost 25 years later, having watched and just be like, oh my gosh, this film is still so incredible. And then you look at, and obviously things are always different with stuff, but you know, it's like, Frank, you look at a lot of the things that he was involved with where things were done for low budget, low time. I think back to Pat LaBelle 2, which he was, you know, did a bunch of layout work for that one too. And that was like, that movie was, as we were stunned to find, was like 9 months or something from green light to in theaters, which is just insane. But I just think it's really stunning that they produce something of this quality that still looks good and is
cost
such
about what a house in California does, let's be real.
Yeah,
for the cost of just one house you can have a feature-length anime movie from Madhouse.
That is quite
the statement.
That's actually a tempting trade-off.
I know.
yeah that's true. Good lord, you guys.
That is that comparison is frankly astonishing.
Yeah.
But yeah. I totally agree. I have been more critical of this one, but it's not to say I didn't like it. It's just honestly, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think Conan did a bad movie. I like all four. All for different reasons. I would say Millennium Actress, just from how it tells a story, I think this resonates with me the least. But it doesn't mean that I dislike the movie. There are parts of the movie I thought were phenomenal. I remember I said it when I watched it, and I still hold to the statement. The scene when she was the wandering samurai or the ninja, uh-huh. That ninja fight scene,
oh, so good. With
the rival, is probably the best animated ninja fight scene in all of animation, on all of anime. I'm hard pressed to think of a ninja fight scene that looked as represented what being a Japanese ninja was, with like the replacement, right, with the log and the weapons they're using, like the Kusarigama. Like, to me, that's like, that is what being an effing ninja in Japan is about.
Also, like, kind of film period accurate too, right? Like,
yeah, like the sound effects of the swords clanging was like really overt and like, you know, very 70s feeling. Just like it all, that scene is probably my favorite in the movie. It's just done so well from many angles, and then they still add in the kind of gag at the end where Genya comes in as like the wandering samurai. You know, he does the invisible cut and they all just collapse. Like, it's that part of it, I did appreciate the kind of campy hokiness of that with stellar animation to back it up.
Yeah, the animation definitely just lived up to standards for sure. It's just incredible.
And the animation director and sub-character designer of Takeshi Honda, he honestly, like, just looking at the stuff that he's done, his pedigree is, aside from working on all the Eva stuff, it might be the most impressive, like, animation and, like, key animation, like, pedigree of, like, literally anyone in anime. It's so insane. Like, he's worked on tons of Ghibli movies. Key animation for, like, then to stuff of, like, key animation of episode one of You're Under Arrest OVA. You're like, oh, yeah, one of those things that looks incredible.
You mean, like, the best episode of all of UA?
Yeah, exactly. And then to, like, other stuff of, like, working on tons of stuff with Gainax, back to, like, you know, things of, like, animation director for Otaku no Video. Like, so many key animations on so many things that are just insane. You know, all the Evas. He moved his way up in the Eva movies, from Eva movie one being a key animator, and then movie two animation director, the movie three chief animation director, than movie four up into doing more of the original character design work. And then, like, all of the Ghibli movies. I'm not sure what I'm going for there, other than
he's a phenomenal animator.
He's
a rare breed among rare breeds, really, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so. key animation on Giant Robo Episode 1 as well, like...
Key animation on Gumbuster. Like, yeah. You're talking about things that we've talked about on the show that sit at the heap of a very prestigious mountain, right?
And so. Including, most importantly, on Cream Lemon Episode 4.
Of course.
He's another Cream Lemon Episode 4 alum. Yeah, that might be the
key
most
animator
important.
On 0083 Stardust Memory, which is possibly my favorite Gundam OVA. Like, it's, the list is...
And one of the best animated OVAs ever.
Yeah, it's like, he is decorated among decorated animators. Like, you're not going to find... There's probably maybe three people in the industry still who have this pedigree that are still active.
Yeah, like, maybe.
Maybe. He's sitting in very rare company. I mean, to put into consideration that he worked on the original EVA, you know, on various episodes, and then also, I believe, director for the opening, which, you know, it just may be one of the best openings of all time, all the way through all of the Rebuild movies.
Yeah.
That alone is stellar. And then you're talking about all sorts of other stuff. Like, I didn't even know this till I just looked it up. He did all of the animated cutscenes for Lunar the Silver Star Story, which just got released, actually. So.
Yeah.
Even spreads beyond anime.
Yeah, So, I'm not sure what my point is there, other than it was very intentional that Cohn wanted him to do it, because he needed to have a lot of these people that could do the subtle and the bounciness, because... There's so much stuff in the end, and then, like, the scenes of the that ninja fight is incredible. And it's just, I think this movie too, I look at it and it might be, it's possible this movie, I would put it up there as like the best, probably like maybe one of the best storyboarded movies that I've seen, just because I see the storyboard being put into film with this, and you're just like, oh my gosh, it's so good. Like, again, with everything with Satoshi Kon, there's just so much care put into everything. I don't know what my point is there.
I think what's more impressive is, out of all four movies, maybe with the exception of Tokyo Godfathers, I feel like Millennium Actress is the one that very easily could have been live action, because I can't think of too much in it that was like, oh, this has to be done in anime. But... Because they did animate it with such care, like, because so many of the action sequences and motions aren't particularly, let's call it, traditional anime, right? Like, her chasing, you know, running down the train station early on, like, all those things, like, you could easily do that in real life. You're not trying to do, you know, crazy, you know, super-powered demon versus ninja fights or anything like that. It's just... A girl running, you know, trying to chase a guy who's on a train that's going away, could very easily be filmed. But because it was animated, and animated so well that it looks that good, is so impressive to me.
But I think the other part that does make it a little bit harder is, like, all of the, you know, it's individual parts. I'd say, yeah, you could do it like that. But I think when you put it together as the sum total, then doing it not in anime makes it crazy. Plus, there's all of the really interesting stuff with the color palettes in the movie.
Absolutely. This probably has my favorite color palettes, for sure.
Do it with modern CG and on, like, a soundstage, because otherwise just the number of locations you would need would make it really expensive, I think.
You certainly couldn't do it for... Yeah, you could kind of do with crappier equipment, but yeah, you wouldn't probably be able to make this movie live for $1.2 million.
Definitely not that, yeah, for sure. Not on the same budget.
Particularly if I need to watch it more closely to see how they're shading, you know, the character designs for other things, but I noticed during the Edo part that they transformed the character designs at one point to be nudged toward wood block prints, and along with the backgrounds and other things.
Yeah. Yeah, there was so much of that care and trying to change things to match in with this melding of the actual films that they were making, plus their memories of the time period, plus
it's all references false... to actual films that I wish I had right. the Japanese cinema knowledge to know of.
Yeah.
Right, plus all of the actual film references and stuff. I love the ones towards the end where they do the kind of the rapid cut where it's always the Professor Fujiwara who's going in to stop Godzilla and all the other stuff there.
Yeah. The stuff that they never really gave much time to before.
So, shockingly, after discussing another Satoshi Kon movie for an hour, we could probably keep going on for quite a while, but we are rapidly running out of time. I'll ask for last thoughts, favorite scenes, whatever, anything you want to discuss of something. I will go with myself first, and I'll say just the music is incredible. This was the first time that Susumu worked with Kon, and our lives are all immensely better for that.
Oh, yeah.
And I wish the soundtrack were available, and I'm just glad that the film is up on Crunchyroll, because there was quite a number of years there where the film was largely inaccessible in the U.S. because the U.S. disc releases were out of print and it wasn't up on any service, and that's a disservice to humanity.
I'm glad Kon's work is accessible again, because it was unfortunate that it interacted badly with the Leto O's anime crash as far as the licensing on some of it.
Yeah, it did. A lot of it came at a poor time, I agree. Dylan, in addition to our wrap-up, since this is the last of his movies, could you also add if your rating has changed at all after now we've rewatched all four?
Yeah.
My rating, I'm going to go... they're all for number one in my heart, and I hate you for making me choose. Cop out. I think I might keep Perfect Blue first. I think I might. It's so good. It's so wild. It's such an interesting thing. So I think I'm going to keep Perfect Blue first, and I'm probably going to put Paprika. Is that second? Is Millennium Actress down to third? Gosh, I don't know. If I had to say, I think I would do Perfect Blue, Paprika, Millennium Actress, Tokyo Godfathers.
Interesting.
And I feel horrible for putting anything in an order like that.
Right.
Well,
I'm a horrible person.
You're rating them, but the delta between them probably isn't very much, right? Like, there's probably not much of a gap from... between even one through four for you.
No, and it's like, would I recommend any of those movies over what... Oh, God, I wanted to share a picture of the other thing that was recommended when I finished watching this on Crunchyroll. Oh. It was some horrible... What the heck? I had a picture of it. One second here.
That it was Mabu Raho.
It was even worse. It was Mabu Raho.
Oh my gosh, it's on Crunchyroll.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was just like, wow. Well, talk about going from peak of things that people care and put care and effort into in the peak of zero care.
Yeah. It's a paycheck.
Yeah. it's a paycheck and not even a good one. I'm splitting hairs here amongst things that hairs should not be split over. All right, I'll pass it on to Nick.
Yeah, so I think while it seems like I was very critical of this movie, I think it was just because out of his four, it's the one that resonates with me the least. That being said, like I said earlier, I think the ending to me was probably my favorite, just because... it was, it was very melancholy, right? Like, she's dying, but she's dying at peace for the first time in probably decades. So, you know, I think ultimately that's probably for the best. So, but again, I don't think my... Ooh, does my rating change? So, for me, Perfect Blue is, I would say, comfortably number one still. I don't think the other three really speak to me as much as Perfect Blue did. Honestly, if anything was going to change, because I think originally I had Millennium Actress at 2, I might actually slip Tokyo Godfathers into 2, but I feel like it's really close. I feel like 2 and 3 are super close between Tokyo Godfathers and Millennium Actress. And as much as I hate to say it, I think Paprika actually falls to 4th pretty easily for me. Again, not saying that it's a bad movie, but just out of the 4, I feel like it is the messiest of Kon's from a plot perspective, when the other 3 I feel like are quite tight on plot. So I think that's probably why I would put it down, even though from a technical execution standpoint, it's a stellar movie. So, yeah, I think that's my final standing. So if I had to actually number it, it would be Perfect Blue. Then let's call it... I'll keep it the same. Yeah, let's call it Millennium Actress, and then Tokyo Godfathers, and then Paprika, with 2 and 3 being relatively interchangeable.
All right, let's go with Mike.
As far as... affecting my order, I think I'm still where I was when I came in, which was with Paprika just slightly behind the other three, and then which of the other three I'd put first depends which day you ask me, because they're honestly so close, and I like them for different reasons. Like, this one, the thing that I love about it is that it captures, in a way that would be really hard in live action, what it's like to have a really captivating storyteller, you know, in a room with you, which is something that you can't really capture on film. For some reason, it just doesn't translate, but doing it this way, it actually did.
That's a good point. I totally agree.
Yeah.
All right, Sam?
Let's see. Yeah, I don't really have any extra thoughts to give. It's such a really powerful emotional movie, even though, like, I kind of did mention, like, once she starts running to Hokkaido, it kind of started sagging that bit for me. But, like, oof, it really pays off. Like, it picks up and just ends just really well. It really gets you. As far as my ranking goes, I feel like almost exactly the same as Nick, where I'm like, I think Perfect Blue is going to be my top one now. And Millennium Actress, I think it's still number 2. But in this rewatching, I kind of see some more of its flaws. But I think it's still better than Tokyo Godfathers, which I'll keep at 3. And then, obviously Paprika at 4. Yeah, the Perfect Blue, I think, has pulled ahead to the top spot for me.
So you go in chronological order.
Oh yeah, I guess so, huh? what is that? Well, no. Oh yeah, it is, huh? What does that say?
It's because I think Paprika and Tokyo Godfathers are pretty close to each other. I think they have the smallest gap out of all of them. So.
Okay, so with that, thank you for coming along with us for this ride here. Next time, we will be journeying back into the world of really what is our bread and butter of AMO, which is 90s OVAs. And this time, we're going to go to Armitage 3. So, I'm still not exactly sure. I actually haven't started watching it yet. I don't know if the version I got off Apple TV has Japanese or if it's just dub or not. It's a little hard one to find, so if you got to surf the seas, you do what you got to do. And there's, so I believe, what, the good stuff is the original OVA, and then there's the quad matrix, which is condensed into a single movie, and then there's a completely poly matrix, and then there's a separate dual matrix, which was a different movie, which Nick does not recommend, which was made in like 2001, and I definitely want to watch that, because anything we'd recommend not watching, I definitely need to check out.
Touch the hot stove. Yes.
It's watchable, but the original Armitage the Third OVA is like peak 90s OVA. When you're talking about 90s OVA, this should be on the Mount Rushmore of 90s OVAs, and I will die on that hill.
All right. We'll see. We'll see if we're all still willing to die on that hill with Nick next time, or if he's dying alone on that hill, or if he decides to get off the hill and leave us up there alone. And as a final thing, I did give the description with all the warnings about House 1977 to some other folks I was hanging out with, and a couple people were like, "Oh man, this movie is my jam. I'm all in on this complete mess. It sounds great."
Awesome.
Yeah. So, so with that, I say thanks for listening, and until next time, unless next time is in the future or already remembering this as we go back in the past, or this is all just a dream, but as long as you perceive it as next time, this is AMO Kenzoku saying Saraba.